This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Elaine Bartlett, a single mother of four, was given the sentence of 20 years to life in 1983 for selling 4 ounces of cocaine. It was a first-time drug offense. She says she needed money and was talked into transporting and selling the cocaine by a man who turned out to be a police informant. 16 years later, at the age of 42, she was granted clemency by Governor George Pataki. The new book, Life on the Outside, describes the difficulty she's faced returning to the outside world. The book was written by journalist Jennifer Gonerman, who is also my guest. Gonerman says we are now witnessing the long-term consequences of the get-tough policies in the war on drugs. Many of the long prison terms from the 70s and 80s have ended. Men and women, like Elaine Bartlett, scarred from the years behind bars, are trying to re-enter society with no money, few job skills, and little education. Last week, the American Bar Association published a report saying mandatory minimum sentences for small-time drug offenders are unfair and should be abolished. Bartlett's tough sentence was part of the Rockefeller drug laws, which were passed in New York in 1973. I asked Gonerman to describe the law.
New York State's drug laws, known as the Rockefeller drug laws because they were created by then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller in 1973, really helped to kick off the nation's war on drugs by establishing a system of mandatory minimum sentences so that anybody in New York State who was convicted of selling at least 2 ounces or possessing at least 4 ounces of heroin or cocaine would receive a mandatory sentence of 15 to life minimum. In Elaine's case, the judge added 5 extra years, and that's why she got 20 to life. But with the mandatory minimum drug laws, it doesn't matter whether the defendant is a kingpin, a first-time offender, just a drug mule. The level of involvement has nothing to do with the length of the sentence. The only thing that determines the length of the sentence is the weight of the drugs involved.
The laws were created for the kingpins. There was no way to prove that I was a kingpin. Nothing in my life stated that I was a kingpin. At the time I was arrested, I was 26 years old, mother of four, on welfare. I had $5 in my pocket when I was arrested. I didn't own anything. I didn't have anything. So when they did an investigation on me, there was nothing to warrant that I lived the lifestyle of a kingpin, so I couldn't understand why the judge would sentence me a first-time offender with 20 to life.
Jennifer Gonerman, what was the philosophy behind the Rockefeller laws?
I'm not sure whether there was a really well-thought-out philosophy behind them. At this time, Nelson Rockefeller had been governor of New York State for a while, had repeatedly tried to win the Republican nomination for president without luck. And essentially, he was trying to shore up his conservative credentials so that he could win that presidential nomination. And I think he viewed the Rockefeller drug laws, which were going to be the strictest in the entire country, as a way to try to get those credentials and put himself onto the national stage. And in fact, what he did do was launch a real shift in crime control policy for the entire country. Virtually every state copied New York State's drug laws and passed their own version of mandatory minimum sentencing.
When you went to prison, Elaine, you had 4 children.
Yes.
They were young. They were ages 1, 2, 6, and 9. Both their parents were in jail. Your mother initially took care of your children when you were imprisoned. Was she in a good position to do that?
Not really. She wasn't. But it was never a question as to whether my mother was going to take my children or not. That's just the type of woman that she was. And once I got arrested, I had to notify her and let her know that I was locked up. So automatically she took care of my children. My mother raised 13 grands because I had a couple of sisters and brothers that were strung out on drugs and not capable of taking care of their own children, so she took on their kids, too.
Your mother died when you were in prison. How many years had you been in prison when she died?
I had been in prison almost 14 years when my mother started really getting sick, and she died in 1998.
So there was still like a year or two left
yes,
for you in prison before you got out. So who took over the parenting of your children?
My younger sister stepped up and took some of the younger kids out the household that needed taken care. And my son, Apache, gave up his basketball scholarship and came back home. and took on the responsibility of being a parent.
Were your children getting in trouble while you were in prison?
My son Jamal, my youngest son Jamal, started getting into trouble at a very young age. I'd say about the age of 12, he started getting into little trouble, and then it led to other things. And when I came home from prison, I had to go to jail to see my son, who was locked up for selling drugs.
How old was he when he was convicted?
Jamal was about 16.
Now, do you blame your own imprisonment? Do you blame your absence for his troubles and for the other problems that your children had? Or do you think that, you know, some of this might have happened anyways? I mean, you know, I know you were talked into it, but still you were involved in a drug cell, and your boyfriend, who became your husband, had been selling drugs. So it's not something that was unknown to the family.
For me, of course, I blame myself some, but I don't blame myself to where as I feel helpless, because I could have been home and the same type of things could have happened. But I feel that when they sentenced us under the Rockefeller drug lords for such a long period of time, you not only sentenced the person or the mother that's being convicted, you sentenced the whole family. Because my children had to come see me in prison for 16 years, so everything they know about me is what we shared in the visiting room. And basically, what you're telling our children, that it's all right, that prison is all right, it's a way of life, it's all right to accept that, and it's not. And you would think that me receiving a 20-year-life sentence, that none of my children would have got involved with drugs or been in jail. For a mother to come home after 16 years and basically the love that you have for your family is what keeps you strong and alive and help you to survive them 16 years and not go crazy, not lose your mind, and not become dependent on any type of medication just to make it through the day while you're locked up. That's the hardest thing for a mother to deal with.
What effect do you think it had on your children to visit you in prison? Some people would think, like, what a great deterrent. Who would ever want to go to prison after seeing what life is like for their mother behind bars? Do you think it scared them? You know, the whole Scared Straight program, where you take young children to prison just to see how horrible it is. The theory is that they'll be so appalled and afraid that they'll stay away from crime. So what effect do you think it had on your kids to visit you in prison?
I think that it made them feel hopeless. My kids never stopped loving me. Even though I was locked up for such a long period of time, they still carried the love that they had for me. I still carried the love that I had for them. And when you're in prison, you live in two worlds. Because when you come down to the visiting room, you basically try to make the best of them 6, 7, or 8 hours of whatever time you have to spend with your family. You don't talk about what your everyday life in prison is like. I made a mistake in my life. I'm not saying that I'm not guilty of delivering that package. Yes, I did that, and that's what I did. But me delivering a package, did it really deserve for me to sit in prison for 16 years? Did my family deserve to be affected psychologically, mentally, and the fact that they have no hope, no dreams? Do you know what it is? My mother didn't want me to go to prison. It's not that we raise our children to go out there and get involved in drugs or sell drugs. I hear people talk about in our communities, our kids are not on the street selling drugs. Of course your kids are not on the street selling drugs. In your communities, your kids have different options.
When you got out of prison, your children were 16 years older than they were when you went
right in.
So your children who had been 1, 2, 6, and 9 were now 17, 18, 22, and 25. Did you feel like you knew them when you saw them after prison?
To be honest with you, in prison, I felt like I really knew them. But once I got home, no, I didn't know them. We was complete strangers. And my youngest daughter, Nene, whose name is Elaine, like mine, she said, who are you to come home and tell me what to do with my life and what's not right with my life after 16 years? You abandoned me. You left me. You shouldn't have never went to jail in the first place. So you didn't care. So who are you to come home and tell me what to do now? She feels that my mother was her mother, which is right, because I birthed her, but my mother raised her. So she'll say to me, my mother is dead. You're my biological mother, but you're not my mother. My mother died.
That must not make you feel very good.
It doesn't make me feel good. And when I came out of prison, you know, I had people tell me, Lane, they're teenagers now. You know, they're not young no more. You can't change what happened. Just walk away. But for a mother to come out here and see that your family has became stuck, that your family has basically just given up on life, how can you just walk away from a situation like that? I'm not saying that I created the whole situation, but I did play a major part in the situation. So how do you walk away?
Jennifer Gonerman, your new book is about Elaine Bartlett and her life in and outside prison. What are some of the parts of her story about her return from prison back to her home, back to her family? Parts of that story that you think are kind of typical of other people's stories when they get out of prison?
There's many ways in which Elaine's homecoming is very typical, other ways in which it's atypical.
Mm-hmm.
The tensions and resentment that she was talking a bit about with her daughters, the attitude of where have you, you know, why should we be listening to you? Where have you been for 16 years? You know, we got along fine without you, not really making a place for her anymore. I think that's very, very typical of people coming home from prison, this sense of role loss. I mean, Elaine tried very hard to reclaim her role as head of the family when she first came home. The house was a disaster area. The family was in shambles. So I think regaining that respect, that authority, reclaiming the role of head of household is something that's pretty common with men and women coming out of prison. And it creates, obviously, a great deal of tension. And I think is part of the reason why many people end up back in prison. I mean, when we talk about the recidivism rates, which is incredibly high, you know, you often hear about people relapsing, using drugs again, or committing other crimes, and that's all obviously true. But there are a great deal of parole violations which stem out of family dysfunction or family tensions. Also, you have one family member telling another family member, you know, if you don't do this or that, I'm going to call your parole officer on you. And parole becomes a kind of second invisible punishment, a way for one, you know, one family member to have power or control over another family member.
President Bush has proposed a $300 million prison reentry initiative to expand job training and placement services and provide transitional counseling. Jennifer, what are your thoughts on that proposal?
Well, he announced that proposal, you know, in January at his State of the Union address, and I thought it was fantastic that he was addressing what I think is a very, very crucial major national political issue. But I don't think $300 million even begins to tackle the issue. You know, we now spend about $55 billion a year on our prison system. Virtually all of that money, of course, is used to lock people up, and virtually none of it is used to turn people back from prisoners back into civilians. So I'm glad that he's starting to think about ways in which to ease these transitions. The federal government is putting more and more money into that. But I think we have a long way to go until we make that happen. I mean, I think preparing people to reenter society needs to start from the moment that they enter the prison system.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Elaine Bartlett, Jennifer Gonerman, thank you very much.
Thank you.